The Five Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM Portland.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome to another Saturday morning in Portland, Oregon. And my name is Chuck Price. I'm President Wealth Manager with the Price Financial Group Wealth Management Firm. And in studio today is with me is co-host Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing great, Carl. And if my voice holds on, I'll be doing great. We've got an exciting show today, and for you listeners who are regular listeners, if you're a new listener, you know that once a month we talk to either Harry Dent or we talk to Rodney Johnson, co-editor of the free newsletter Survive and Prosper, and you can get that free newsletter at www.harrydent.com, or you can go to my website at www.pfgwm.com, and there's a link there that you can sign up for it. And so we're going to be having Rodney on the line here with us shortly. And so this is your opportunity to call to a famous economist who writes newsletters about the economy, and you can call 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, Carl, you and I are here in the studio alone today because Kevin's out running the hood to coast.
Well, I understand that he, is about this time, should be running what is supposed to be the most difficult leg as well. But we know that Kevin is up to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got Rodney Johnson, and he's on the line with us. Rodney, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, Rodney, we're real excited to have you on the phone, and I don't know if you heard the intro there, but I did tell people that you are a co-editor with Harry Dent of Survive and Prosper, and I explained to them how they can go on the web on my website and sign up for it, and they can also go on your website, which I gave them the information for, so people can sign up to get the free newsletter.
That sounds great.
And it's a daily newsletter, and I got to tell you, I'm very excited about this newsletter because I think it's a great opportunity for people who are self-investors and people who just want to know what's going on in the market to get a chance to hear from two people like you and Harry. It's very interesting to read the comments of the two of you, and I particularly liked the one you wrote this past week on gold.
Oh, it's Yeah, and I assume like you, you know, we get so many questions on gold because it's a commodity, an asset, whatever you want to call it, that did so incredibly well during the darkest days of the financial crisis. It did have a dip, but then came back, and of course, you know, went from the mid-200s at the beginning of the decade up to, you know, 1900 here 2 years ago. And everybody's just asking, well, what is it next? It's like, well, I don't know. What do you think it should be? And therein lies the fight, right? Should gold be anything? And our view is, of course, it's a commodity. And so like other commodities, as things slow down and a lot of the, you know, the real angst of the market falls away, that gold comes back. And that's exactly what it's done. It fell back below 1,300. It's now around 1,370 or so. And so it's bouncing around, but it's not making that meteoric rise that was projected by so many people, you know, up to 5,000 or something. So sometimes you got to stand back and ask yourself, I hear all the noise. What's really happened? And what's happened over the last couple of years is not a lot.
Well, I thought your analogy of what would have to happen for gold to go to those prices, and you virtually can't turn on any of the business networks without seeing a gold advertisement.
Yeah, it's amazing that the gold advertisements you're talking about, and I know the listeners are seeing these same things, and, you know, and gold's an asset, and it's been money for thousands of years, and the money of kings and all that. That may be true, but I'd like for you to take a piece of gold, go down to the 7-Eleven, and try to get a Slurpee. It's not going to work out. I mean, you can't use that as money because it's not money in our society. I completely understand the value of it and how people assess the value, but it's not currency. You can't use it for your daily life. The power company's not going to take it. Your bank isn't going to take it as payment for a car note, and you're certainly not going to be trading it for, you know, chewing gum or something else down the street. And so you have to live your daily life. So what you're betting on is that major currencies fall so dramatically that the value of gold shoots higher, and yet the major currencies are what we need to live day to day. We think the dollar's in a strong place, but even if it's not as strong as we think it is, it's still what we use to function, and so do hundreds of millions of other people.
Well, it's very interesting because you're right. I get asked about gold. Clients want to dump a whole bunch of money in gold, and I always tell them, especially if somebody's a doom and gloomer and they think everything is going to collapse and they're going to have gold, I got news for you. If I got food and you got gold and my food's running out, I don't care how much gold you're giving me. I'm not giving you my food.
It's still not going to fill your belly or keep your children warm at night.
No,
so if
not.
We fall to that point, as you talk about, you know, and everything falls to zero, gold's just as useless as it was the day before.
Well, I did want to mention, Rodney, I have Carl Jepson in the studio with me. He's an estate planning attorney that I do seminars with, and he's been a co-host of mine for many, many years.
Good morning, Rodney. How are you?
I'm well, Carl. How are you?
I'm well, and I've been interested in your recent newsletters. You drew an analogy, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, but basically it had to do with the Japanese animated sort of movies, and you sort of basically said, you know, really, really, we really can't look at some of these indicators and then say that it's really has a causal connection with the effect in the market. And I really appreciated that because a lot of times you hear people talking on the radio or on TV about some indicator about why the market did something, and it's like, you know, that doesn't make any sense at all. It's like, you know, if you turn your lights off, you'll get a cheaper water bill. It's just like, I don't get it. So, and I thought that was really well done.
Well, thank you. And it's the confusion of causality and correlation that you're referring to. And without going into the long Japanese anime story, you know, a great way to explain it to people that they'll immediately understand is there was what's called the January effect in stocks, where we tend to get a pop in stocks every January. And so anyone could look at that and say, well, if stocks tend to go up in January, that means that every January on the calendar, stocks must go up. And it's like, no, no, no. It just means that they happen to coincide where January on the calendar and a rise in stocks happens. But, of course, all of us in America know why it happens. It's because of all of the tax planning that people do in the last months of the year where they rearrange what they're doing and then they go purchase in January and drive the markets higher. If we changed the tax year for everyone from December 31st to June 30th, well, then we would say stocks went up every July instead of January. Don't confuse correlation, meaning that they kind of happen together, with causality, because they don't have to be the same.
Yeah, and one of the things true is about that is that's when people start the new year off and everybody starts dumping money into their retirement plan that they hadn't done the year before, and they want to start the new year right, and they start putting money into their 401k or their IRA, and then the problem is they don't keep doing it all year long.
Right, but if we change that date from when you have to do it to, you know, the months leading up to April 15th, if we changed it out to some other time in the summer, we would change how the markets worked on it. So it has nothing to do with the calendar, has everything to do with how we set up the tax laws. And so
you're exactly correct. I heard, I can't think who it was that said this on the, I was listening to a radio program the other day, and somebody said that what we need to do is we need to have our tax bill due the same time we vote.
Oh.
Then people would have a direct correlation between paying their taxes and what they're voting for. Kind of put the onus back on the person who's pushing the lever.
I like that. But, of course, that would never get passed as a law because those people who pass laws are the ones that want the votes.
Well, that's exactly right. Well, you know, one of the things we talked about last week, and I'm going to kind of throw a curveball here at you, I guess, but I talked last week about General Motors. And the fact is they ran all these ads on TV, but the reality is they still haven't paid back the Americans for all the money we gave them to bail out. And in fact, the deficit running in their pension plan and the deficits running in that company, that stock needs to go to $90 a share for us to get back our money.
And I think you're correct. I have not calculated the numbers because they change as they have over the last several years. They keep getting higher as to what the stock price has to be. And it's because General Motors was mostly owned after the bankruptcy, and then it came back public, mostly owned by the United States Treasury. And so we owned a big chunk of it. The unions owned a lot of stock in both their pension fund and their health care plan. It's called a VEBA, but in their health care. And the Canadians owned a little bit of the chunk as well. The problem is, as the deficit gets bigger for what they owe for benefits, it means that the value of that stock has to go higher and higher to make up for it. And that hasn't really happened. And, of course, the other piece of this is they're not interested in paying it back because the company itself isn't making any payments. What's going on instead is the United States government is really hoping that the share price goes up in the market so the United States government can sell their shares to someone else, anyone else. The money still doesn't come out of the company. What they got was a $50 billion pass, and that would be awfully nice for anybody who runs a business.
$50 billion, that's a little bit of dinero.
That's a little bit of dinero. And yeah, they talk about how profitable they are. It's like, well, let's see. Your debts were wiped away. You got a $50 billion investment you didn't have to do anything for. And you were able to break all of your union contracts and come back with two-tiered labor and all sorts of other things. Yeah, I think that makes you more profitable. It would do wonders for me and my business.
Yeah, but the reality is they still owe it. And they've got a major, major tidal wave coming in their pension funding.
They could, but the problem then in particular for the UAW that I have is that you and I and the listeners are all on the hook for that because a large piece of that pension and the benefits that they receive were codified as a debt of the United States government. And so there's a whole piece of this that Americans are on the hook for at the gold plate levels that they had for so many years. Typically, when a company goes bankrupt, the people who are currently receiving a pension, currently receiving, not future retirees, but the current recipients, they have their benefits cut to match a very minimal level that's put out by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, and it gets paid by this government entity, this kind of insurance company. Well, the UAW didn't do that. When they went bankrupt, when the Chrysler went bankrupt, and Delphi, by the way, people forget the auto supplier, when Delphi went bankrupt, their current retirees had their benefits taken over by basically the government at the gold-plated level. They didn't have them cut. No other pensions ever had that gift.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I've never heard that before.
It's just one of those things. There were so many things we were dealing with. And certainly, you know, you and your practice with your clients and keeping people on track, all the research that was going on at the time in 2009 when this occurred, in 2010, and people living their daily lives, it's really hard to keep track of all this, but this is what our elected officials in Congress did. They passed a law that basically said this one time we're going to allow this to happen for a very select group of people, and they treated them differently under the law. And it still galls me. That's why, you know, as you know, when I write in my newsletter, I still hate government motors. I drive a Chevy Suburban that I love as a member of the family, but I won't buy a new one because I don't agree with how it happened.
It's interesting. I was just going to say that I have this old Chevy Impala that I really, really like, but it does has a chilling effect on me.
And I drove my Suburban back from, you know, my daughter's volleyball this morning to be on the call and part of this morning, and I just love this truck. It has treated us right for 154,000 miles, but I see the new ones go by, and I just shake my head.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things I talk about weekly on our show, and I give a stock report, and one of the things it kind of drives me a little nuts when I watch Fox Business or CNBC or any of the business networks, because they don't, I guess the right word is they don't respect the economic outlook of demographics. versus the economy. You very seldom hear the only time they ever mention demographics if Harry Dent's going to be on and talk about demographics. but when you really boil down the market and you boil down the country, if the country's ran by the market and the country's ran by the spending of American citizens, what the heck is that if it isn't demographics?
We completely agree. And, you know, our basic premise is that how people spend money drives the economy, and the economy eventually drives the markets. It can get out of whack from time to time, certainly, both above and below. But by and large, how you and I as individuals choose to spend our money can drive different areas up or down. We bought many, many minivans in the 90s. And it was all of the soccer moms from the baby boom trying to get their kids from point A to point B. Minivans are not a popular type of vehicle anymore. It's the smaller luxury up car that appeals to the boomers who are empty nesters. It is what it is. And you can see how people's point in their life, their age and stage of life, drives how they spend and can drive an outcome in the market. And right now you'll see so many people, and you see it on all the networks, that Americans have lowered the amount of debt they're carrying in terms of their household debt versus their income. And it's absolutely true. But the furtherance that you often hear is because they've lowered the amount of debt that they're carrying, they're now available to go take on new debt to spend a lot more money. So we're looking at a potential rise in the economy because everybody's going to go back and take on new debt. And that leaves Harry and me in the corner waving our hands saying, wait. So many Americans in the boomer group are past the point of spending a lot. They're trying to save for retirement. What makes you think they're going to rush out and take on new debt? Everybody I meet is trying to lower the debt that they have on their balance sheet, not raise it. So just because they've done a good job so far doesn't mean they're going to go back and ramp up the credit cards once again.
You know, Rodney, you know, part of my practice involves what they call elder law. And one of the things that we hear at continuing legal education seminars all the time is this huge demographic shift of the people who are going to require elder law type services, and the effect that has on the economy, which I'm sure just beyond the purchasing part of it, but they're going to become a much greater burden, I suppose myself included, on everybody else, because, you know, for example, in the court system. We have seen a huge rise in the number of conservatorships and guardianships that are required, but our court staffs are being reduced, and so it's just getting harder and harder and harder to get things through the court where there's a genuine need sometimes, and so that effect is one of those things that a lot of us just don't see, and I wonder, you know, what your thoughts are on the sort of the downside of the boomers becoming, you know, seniors.
Well, I think it's a fabulous thing because
some of the obvious things. So
I don't want to go out and disparage, you know, boomers moving into their next stage of life, being retirement, and of course growing in age and becoming older seniors. But I would clearly caution and ask people to prepare, because what you're talking about is one of the big holes in how we provide for our society. We talk about care for the elderly and Medicaid, but I mean, certainly in your position, you recognize what it takes to get somebody from home care to a hospital to a Medicaid care situation, and the paperwork involved with your assets is just, it's phenomenal. And just being in a joint checking account with someone so that you can take care of some of their bills, or just getting a power of attorney for different accounts so that you can actually move their life along as perhaps they become more forgetful or need some assistance along the way that the elderly person doesn't recognize. And that's the piece where I believe you're speaking to, is our system isn't set up for dealing with the immediate need, because by the time you get in front of somebody to say, look, we need some guardianship for this particular person, and they say, well, we'll hear that case in 3 months, that's 3 months where something terrible could be happening because it doesn't exist. And so preparing for that now and having those conversations with adult children is one of the best things that people can do, and there's so little attention given to that right now.
Amen. Preach it.
Yeah, a lot of our practice is estate planning, and of course, Carl and I, we have our clients getting older and older, and it's very hard sometimes when I have somebody who's been a client of mine for 40 years, and I remember when they were young and working, and I was a lot younger too, but they were young, working, vibrant, and now they're much older, and they're not able to do the things they were able to do. And some of these people have led, you know, tremendous lives, and now all of a sudden they're at a point in their life where they need assistance and they need help.
And they need it now. They don't need it in a year or two. It's just going to be some magnitude worse by then.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to change gears up a little bit on that and talk to you about something that's kind of near and dear to me that I do each week. I bring the market update. And what I try to tell people is to get about reality. My practice is all about trying to preserve principle and live to fight another day and to make a reasonable rate of return on your investments. But kind of like the tortoise and the hare, you know, we want to win the race. We're not in an anxious to run it in short spurts and then have big declines and then try to catch up. We try to keep our money and our principal and make a little bit of money and not take that unnecessary risk. And I try to get people to understand that the markets, everybody's talking about this great market upswing we had, but I've been running the numbers from when the market first started down back on 10/9/07. And for example, the Dow Jones right now is only up 6% from what it was on 10/9/07. That means it's made a paltry 1.03% per year for this great market.
It does kind of put it in perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And, I talk to people, and the S&P is up a whopping 1.08. And when you start thinking about that, and you go back historical returns, back prior to the turn of the century, the S&P was over 10.
Well, and you know, I know that you and Carl have been through these numbers, from 10 different directions. But just so people understand, this is, we're higher than we were in 07 by a mere 6% in the markets, and this is 6 years later. But if you look at it, we're a little bit higher, and yet the pieces of the economy seem much worse. We're a little bit higher, and unemployment is over 7%, and we're adding 75% new part-time workers to the economy instead of full-time workers, and we're sitting at GDP growth that if it reached 2%, people would be excited. It's amazing that if we got up to 2% GDP growth, people would be excited. And we're doing it at a time where the Fed is printing $85 billion a month. Billion. This is amazing. And yet people are going, well, it seems okay. It doesn't feel okay to me. It seems terribly out of whack.
Well, you know, I talk to clients all the time about if you just drive around, like in our area, you drive around and look at how many commercial buildings are empty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where small businesses were at one time hiring people, and now they're sitting there and half the little strip mall is empty. And it's, you know, the old half glass full or half glass empty. But the fact is there aren't businesses opening up starting in there to hire people. And if the unemployment situation in this country doesn't turn around, who's going to be making the money to get the economy going to spend to buy those goods to keep it going?
Right.
That's the concern I have.
And it's something that it's hard to get people worked up about because it's a long-term trend. And you don't want to paint a picture of gloom and doom and everything going to zero because it doesn't work that way. You know, I got up this morning. I got the papers before 6:30. I made breakfast. I did all the things I'm going to do. I drove my daughter over to volleyball and different things. I'm going to live my life. But I may be living a little less than I would have before because there's a change in how our economy works. And I'm not alone in this. I mean, hundreds of millions of Americans are in the same boat because we've seen wages stagnate and we're still 6% below where we were in 2007, 2008. And yet our costs for education, health care, and a couple of other things have continued to move up. And so we're just getting hemmed in. It doesn't mean it goes to zero. It means that the growth isn't there. And without the growth, you can't have that move to a robust recovery. You can't build the new opportunities for that young group that's coming in. When you look back, we've had 5 years of college graduates coming into a difficult economy. 5 years, half a decade of new graduates coming in and saying, wait a second, where's my promise of a good job? I did my pieces, now where is it? And we've got a few more years of this coming. And so I like to bring people back to the reality of it's not zero. It's not that this thing just falls apart and, you know, we're trading guns and bullets for food. It's that we have a lower level of economic activity because the growth isn't there.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. I think most people, most of my clients that I see, the ones that are working now are becoming very, very conscious about the amount of money they're making and being able to invest and save. And yep. they've all tightened down their expenditures, every one of them. And they're not spending money, and they're not borrowing money. They're being very, very conservative with their money. And I think there's a big concern, at least the people working whose wages haven't went up the last 3 or 4 years are looking at this thing and saying, hey, you know, we've got to get some better days here coming.
Right. And we think they're there. You know, here at HS Dent, we believe that the better days will be arriving. It doesn't last forever. But we still think we're about 5 years away. We've said from the beginning this is a 10 to, you know, 12, 14-year process. We're hoping it's closer to 10 than 14. But it does take a long time to work out. And so, you know, being in the, you know, third, fourth inning of the game means you got a long way to go, and we'll get there. It seems amazing to look back and say that the beginning of all this in late 07 or, you know, what was it, St. Patrick's Day 2008 when Bear Stearns went under,
yep.
Well, that was 5 years ago. That's a long time.
Oh, yeah, hard to believe that Bear Stearns went. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I tell people when I remember when E.F. Hutton went broke, they had those great ads. Everybody listens to E.F. Hutton.
Yep.
I guess
when
he didn't listen
speaks,
enough.
Everybody listens.
Yeah. And they were so loud, they're totally quiet now forever. But I did want to ask you one quick thing before you go, and that is the Affordable Health Care Act and Obamacare. Right. Now, strictly from an economic standpoint, from your view of economics, mm-hmm. what is going to be, you know, because I hear, on TV, or on the radio, depending on where you turn, you hear one thing, it's going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread, or it's going to be Armageddon.
Oh.
It's like there's no in-between. Everybody's
right.
Saying it's the worst thing that ever happened, or it's the best thing that ever happened. It can't be both.
You know, and I think it's not both. I think it's one or the other, depending on who you are. And a great way to look at affordable care is it's affordable payments. That's what the system is meant to do. And it is a clear wealth transfer program from people who are healthy, who will not use the system, or certainly won't use it to the level of payments that they're going to be required to make, to the people who are not as healthy and they require more care than they could ever pay for. And so as I tell people, it's your kids. Your kids who are in their 20s and 30s who may have health insurance, but probably not because a large chunk of them don't have any because they don't go to the doctor. It doesn't mean they shouldn't. They shouldn't have some catastrophic policy instead if they got, you know, struck by leukemia or hit by a car or something, but they just don't use it, so they tend not to buy it. They're going to be required to pay in a couple hundred bucks a month that is clearly going for people who have rheumatoid arthritis, who have failing kidneys, who have Crohn's disease, who have a lot of the ailments that tend to hit people later in life as our economy sees more and more people in that age group. That's what we're doing. We're transferring money from the young workers to the aging baby boomers because the healthcare system is set up to where we couldn't have paid for it otherwise. It doesn't attack the problem, though. The problem is that we have this system set up where every time we go to a doctor, there's a question of, well, who gets the money? You walk in the doctor's office and it's $80, it's $100. Then they do lab work, it's $50, $100. Well, then they want to do an x-ray just to make sure about something else, and it's $300. And no one really tracks to say, do I need it, and can I shop for it? And until we add that piece back in where you can be an informed consumer and actually make a choice, no, I don't want to buy that, or I want to buy it somewhere else, we'll never contain the cost.
Yeah, I think it's very tough that we're passing this on to the younger generation, the ones that you just talked about that went through school, and now all of a sudden they spend 4 years or 5 years in college and get out and they can't get a job. And now if they hit 26, they're going to be paying a premium of a couple hundred bucks a month when they don't even have a job. I don't know how that's going to work.
Well, and the first thing we said to them was, guess what? You don't have to get insurance until you're 26. We'll just make your parents pay for it more.
Right.
It's like, well, wait a second. How was that a good idea?
I think they were the ones who probably helped them pay for college.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Rodney, listen, we really appreciate you joining us and look forward to it in the months to come.
Well, Chuck and Carl, it's my pleasure. Y'all have a great morning.
Good, and I'll be seeing you, I think, in October.
Sounds good.
Good,
bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You're listening to Investing Simplified. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. If you want to call in and ask a question, you can call 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We're going to come right back with Carl's comments.
Price Financial Group, Wealth Management.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepsen.
And lawyers, guns, and money.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepsen with the Warren Allen Law Firm. It's a little bit difficult to follow Rodney Johnson, but nonetheless, we'll bore it down a little bit. And it was very interesting to listen to what he had to say. And obviously, they do a lot of study on all of the various factors that apply to this complicated thing that we call our economy. But nonetheless, today's Carl's comments is that time when I talk about something that comes up as an idea in my practice that I think that the listeners might want to hear about. And so today, we sometimes have talked about probate, the exciting aspect of probate. But also, one of the things we haven't talked about, I don't think, is what is called a small estate. We all know that probate, for most people, is unpleasant and expensive and takes a lot of time. Well, there is a process called the small estate in Oregon and in Washington. And what it does is it allows what is called a small estate. And a small estate is defined in Oregon as an estate that has no more than $200,000 in real property value and no more than $75,000 in personal property value. So $275,000. So if your estate's over that, you're out of the league or over in either one of those categories. So if you had a $300,000 house and $10,000 in personal property, you wouldn't qualify for a small estate. But anyway, so that's the limits on a small estate in Oregon. The small estate is a process that's a lot simplified and shorter and less expensive to conduct than a standard probate, at least in most cases. And what it involves and is usually estates that have one or two assets or several small assets rather than significant assets. And this would be a situation where those assets have not been transferred to the heirs or devisees by beneficiary designation or joint ownership or transfer on death. So person dies with something in their own name only under $200,000 in real estate or under $75,000 in personal property. So what happens is that a person and almost a number of people qualify, but basically it's an heir, a devisee, or sometimes even a creditor. But it's a person that they call a claiming successor, And sometimes that person's called the affiant or affiant. I've never figured out exactly which one. That's kind of like Impala, Impala. But it's I use affiant or claiming successor. Anyway, that person files what's called an affidavit, a small estate affidavit, in the circuit court in which either the property was located or the decedent died in, or any other place where property might be an issue. And it is essentially an informational thing. It says, you know, who the decedent was, when they died, and all that kind of stuff. If there is a will, you have to file the will with it. The original will has to be filed with the small estate affidavit and filed in the probate court. And also, a certified death certificate has to be filed with the small estate. The once that's filed and you get a certified copy of that small estate affidavit, what happens is that you're required as the claiming successor to mail a copy of that to all known creditors. So if there was a mortgage on the property, you'd have to send it to the mortgage company. If there were, you know, big medical bills or anything like that and you know about them that are owed by the decedent, you have to send a certified copy of this affidavit to those people. And then also, you have to send a certified copy to the state of Oregon, to two places in the state of Oregon, so that in the event that they were receiving benefits, that the state can come and get their piece of the pie back. So once you've done that, there's a four-month waiting period during which creditors can make a claim. There are people who, you know, file the affidavit, take the money, and distribute it to the heirs, and nothing ever happens. The problem is that if a creditor comes back after the four-month period, didn't get the notice, or they file a claim before the four-month period, and you as the claiming successor have distributed all of the assets, well, they're going to look to you, and you're going to be personally responsible for whatever amount they are owed up to the amount that was in the estate that you distributed. So it's probably a good idea to wait the 4 months if you can, or you better darn well be sure that there aren't any creditors out there lurking. And you can almost never really know that for a certainty. So my recommendation usually is to wait the 4 months unless there's some very extraordinary circumstance.
What happens if somebody passes away and the heirs don't do a probate?
Well, it depends on what the property is. In fact, I had this discussion just the other day, and it had to do with a small estate that involves real estate. And this person was basically disagreeing with my statement that you have to do a probate for the small real estate. And I said, well, and the reason was because this person had actually distributed the assets of their parents' estate to all of the people that were named in the will without ever filing anything in the court. Well, I asked this person, I said, so is this asset, were all of the assets, personal property? There was no real property. Well, no, there wasn't. Okay, well, and did you have control over all of this property? I mean, it was in your hands to distribute. And they said, well, yes, it was. And I said, well, so there's your answer. I said, had you had any real estate and you tried to sell the real estate, you wouldn't be able to get any title insurance because you don't have a legal authority to sell it. So is it possible if you have all personal property and it's all under the control? Yeah, but the problem is that a creditor could come back and find you and look to you for distributing the estate before, you know, doing anything with creditors. So that's not necessarily a good thing.
So if you have real estate or some kind of real property, I would assume real estate basically. Mm-hmm. Where you have to change the title, you really can't do that without a probate.
That's right. And a small estate, if it's under $200,000, and there are quite a few properties that are now, and that's market value, not net value. So you have to consider that. But anyway, you really need to do it. It's not a big process. It does take 4 months to totally complete, but it's a real prudent thing to do. And if you're going to try to sell a real estate, you can't do it without it. I had a case some time ago where it was, in fact, in this case, it was a trust. It was a will. It was a will, and it had a very complicated, the lawyer who wrote the will should be, you know, sent away. But anyway, it was very complicated in all of these things because there were a bunch of rental properties. and they were supposed to get income to this person, and this person was supposed to be able to live in this house free, and this other person was supposed to get income. It was really convoluted. And this happened to be in another city, another county, so no one here needs to worry about it. But in any event, I inherited this thing, sort of, from a lawyer from this other county, because the lawyer in the other county basically threw up his hands and said, this is nuts. I can't, we can't do it. Because what had happened was the person, very well-intentioned, went about administering the estate without any kind of probate, kept no records, distributed income, distributed some of the personal property, distributed all of the cash, continued to manage the real property without having any true legal authority to do that, until they decided they were going to sell the house. Well, they were, or one of the houses, and they went to sell a house, and of course the title insurance company says, no, you can't. and then they went and they filed a probate. And then it came time to do an accounting. And the person couldn't do it. They just didn't have the records to do it. And the other lawyer kind of just said, I can't cope with this, and resigned. And I understand that. But I took it on because it was a referral, and basically we had a little creative writing, and we had some negotiations with heirs and things like that, and fortunately a very understanding court. And we ultimately worked the deal out and got it through a standardized probate, and everything was well. But it was very time-consuming and expensive to do it, kind of reconstructing things from, 7 years ago. So anyway, that's what a small estate does, and it's a good thing, but it also has some perils to worry about.
So if you're an executor of an estate, somebody passes away and you're the executor of the will, and they have real property, then you better be prepared to go through probate.
Well, at least the small estate, and if the real property is worth more than $200,000, then it's very prudent just to go with the full probate, and that will give you the court's blessing on doing everything that you do, and will cut off the rights of not only known creditors but unknown creditors if you do it properly. And that don't file legitimate claims.
Now, is that where you get the affidavit of domicile so that you can?
Well, no, not actually. You really don't have to have the probate usually is filed either in the county where the decedent died or where they have property. So if they died here but they have real property in Marion County, you might want to file it there. But you could probably do it in either, now that I think about it. But, it varies as to...
I'm just thinking about, sometimes if clients, we end up getting called in on a case where somebody had passed away, they didn't have a TOD on their stock and their investments, mm-hmm. and they had no beneficiary. And so we have to send affidavits of domicile into the transfer agent to get that title of that stock transferred over, or the mutual fund.
Right,
over
and
the
and I think the reason that they want that is because for probate purposes, for counting the asset, the place where the asset is considered to have been at the time the decedent died is the decedent's domicile. And that is the place where they considered home, the place that they intended to live in. Now they could have been, sometimes people get really, really sick and move across the river, but it might be that Oregon or Washington, whichever way you're going, is still the domicile. So that might be an important factor there.
Okay. They just want to make sure they have a clear title.
Yeah, exactly. That they're the right, they're the right person in the right place to do this. So.
Yeah, and of course, probate. When you go through probate, you can go through a judge, and a judge can basically determine how that probate is set up, particularly if there's no will.
Well, yeah, then it defaults to the distribution of the assets, defaults to what is called intestate succession, and that's just the formula that the various states have as to how you're to distribute your property if you have no will. And that may be significantly different than you really want. Might be the same, but it's kind of what they've developed over the years, and each state is somewhat different. So, or maybe different. Oregon and Washington have a different way of doing that.
Well, you know, I was talking to somebody yesterday about a similar subject about this, and we were talking about the fact that in financial planning, one of the things we talk to our clients about is that most people spend more time planning their vacation than they do their financial plan or their estate or their will.
Oh, and, I think, yeah, that's, you know, that's very true. But they're a little bit more interested in doing it too. I mean, that's one of the things, you know, procrastination, and I understand it. I mean, we all have it. And it's not the most, it's not the thing that you get up on Saturday morning and, you know, and the sun is out and you have your coffee and you say, oh man, I want to do
and
my
estate
planning.
And you listen to
today.
Investing Simplified.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's probably not what happens. But it is important, and the sad thing is that unanticipated negative things can happen if you don't do it. And the other thing is I've found in recent years that I've had a lot of people who sort of start the process. They'll, you know, provide me with half the information, and then I won't hear from them for several months, and I'm going, you know, what is this about? So, but my legal assistant is very diligent at tracking them down and making sure that they're reminded. And ultimately, we get them in and get things done. But it's also much better and it's much more efficient for me that because if I once start the project and then I have to drop the project and then wait another month or 2 months down the road before something happens, then it's hard for me to get back to it. And I end up spending more time on it than I would have otherwise, because I got to relearn whatever it was that I got out of the first bit of information. So, you know, it's not as economical that way for people either. So it's all usually my usual plan is to have people come in, you know, get all of the information as soon as I can, and then do the documents, have them review them. And as soon as they've reviewed them and they're satisfied with them, you know, then make an appointment to come in and sign the things. And usually that process takes anywhere from a week to a month, but depending on what it is and how many things we got to learn, but and it's not good to have it, you know, wait. So once you start it, you know, commit to doing it, and it's painless. It's a painless process, and it's one that almost every one of my clients leaves the office and says, yeah, I'm sure glad I got that done. You know, they really do. So I'll
tell you, their families are sure glad they got it done when something happens. That's for sure. Well, you're listening to Investing Simplified. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. If you want to call in and ask a question, 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over 3 decades, and its 9 attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had $1 million...
Well, you're listening to Investing Simplified, and that's a great question. If I had $1 million, what would you do with it? And that's something we've talked about on the show before numerous times. But, Carl, it's you and I today without Kevin.
Yeah, I know. So the knowledge trust is slightly depleted, I guess, huh?
Yeah,
so,
it's a two-thirds knowledge trust.
It's a two-thirds knowledge trust, yeah.
So if you got a question about taxes, this is probably not the time to call in and ask, since Kevin's not here. And he is busy running the Hood to Coast. And
right.
Speaking about that, I'm going to be – do you know the territory they run?
Well, yeah, kind of.
Now, where do they run from Portland to the coast?
I think they go right out. Well, now that you mention it, I'm not entirely sure. They end up going to Seaside, I think. Is where
so they must
up.
Go out 26.
I think they either go out 26 or, yeah, I think they do. Because they wouldn't run all the way up to Astoria and then down to Seaside. So, yeah, I think they run.
Well, they must block a lane off of then.
I don't know. Because it goes on for, you know.
Yeah, because a lot of that's
day,
two
yeah.
lanes, too, though. So I don't know how they kind of break that off. Mm. Maybe they have roadblocks or whatever. But I know it can be dangerous for the runners out there with people who are driving that aren't paying attention.
Yeah, well, we live not far from the Springwater Trail, and that's part of it that comes through Gresham. And, you know, yesterday they were all of their water stations and, you know, the vans with the team names and the runners were running by and stuff. So saw a lot of people going by.
Yeah, no, that actually started Friday, right?
Yeah, starts Friday and then they run, you know, from Mount Hood on down, runs through Gresham, goes through the part of the Springwater Trail.
And so does it end today or tomorrow?
I think it ends, I think it ends today at late, I think.
Maybe. Okay, because that's a pretty.
Although it might be tomorrow. It takes a long time. It seems like it's like, you know.
Yeah, because I know they have each person running a certain amount of distance, so it's not.
They're like 6 or 8 mile lengths or something like that.
Well, I'm going to kind of give a little stock report here. We kind of talked about it a little bit with Rodney Johnson, but I do want to mention that the on 8/23, the Dow closed at 15,010. It was up 46.62 and up 30 basis points. And now where's the Dow stand versus all-time high on 10,907? Well, we're up a whopping 6%. In 5 years and 10 months, which means 1.03% per year. And that's why I mentioned about the recovery. I don't think the recovery is as robust as everybody's making it out to be. The S&P closed at 1663.47. It was up 6.51. And it's up a whopping 6.28% in the 5 years and 10 months, or 1.08%. Oil closed at 105, and last report it was 107. So good news there is oil's coming down. Hopefully gas at the pump will come down, although seeing's believing. They say we're going to be using less of it, so the price will come down. I don't understand that, but I'm happy. I'm happy as a driver if it comes down. Gold closed at 1396, and last report was at 1368. So it moved up about 18 bucks, 28 bucks. And the 10-year bond rate actually went down. So, you know, maybe the mortgage rates. I know when you read the news and you see the news of all the banks, and I can't remember what, I think it was Wells Fargo announced, one of the large banks announced that they're going to cut a bunch of employees from the mortgage lending department because they are feared that rates are going to start going up, and that means less and less people are going to get mortgage loans. That can't be good for the economy.
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking when Rodney was talking with us earlier that one of the questions I kind of wanted to ask him was one of those really broad questions like, you know, if you could make any suggestion that could be implemented tomorrow, what would be the number one thing that you would do to try to fix the unemployment problem? And I'm sure that's a very complicated answer that he'd have to give us, but I would just wonder what, you know, so if we were going to fix this and we wanted to do the best job we could at fixing it with one thing, what would that be? And
well, that'd be a great question next month to ask Harry Dent when Harry Dent's on our show, because that'd be a great question to ask him.
So I don't know. I think a lot of times we are overwhelmed with the complexity of the economy, and we say, well, so what do you do? I mean, obviously there are some things that we don't do well. We don't hold our country's budget well.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting when you think about the fact that when Harry Dent was on the show a month ago and I think, Carl, you asked him the question. I can't remember if you or who asked him the question about, you know, what they would have done. And he said, well, if we would have not bailed out the banks and the car companies, right now we would be in a roaring economy.
Yeah, he did say that. I asked him that, and he said, yes, we'd be better off. He said it would have been painful at first. He said, but by now we'd be better off.
Yeah, and I think most people who take a look at the economy realize at some point we've got to stop feeding the animal, and we got to stop feeding the bears, and let the market just go down and then revamp itself back up. And that's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to do that to the economy. And it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be easy. And the guy who does it, I kind of relate this economy to kind of Harry Truman at the end of World War II. Harry Truman, a lot of people considered him the bad guy because he was the guy that went ahead and nuked Japan to end the war to save maybe thousands of lives to get the thing over with. And people hated him for it. I mean, there was talk that, you know, he couldn't get elected to dog catcher, and he's one of the few presidents that died broke and didn't have a lot of love from the country after he served as president. Although I think a lot of military people loved him because I think he did save a lot of lives, and he ended a pretty bad war in a time in our history. But that had to be done, and the guy who comes in now is not going to be loved, who's going to have to come in and clean this mess up. Somebody's going to have to make the tough decision. And, you know, our current president likes to be loved. But at some point, if you're going to be commander-in-chief, you got to make those tough cut decisions. And printing money is not the way to do it. You got to make the tough choices. And it's kind of like, you know, running your own company. You know, you guys, you have a partnership and you have partners to deal with, but you guys all have to get together and make the tough decisions to run your company. Sometimes that means hiring staff. Sometimes it means letting staff go. And we have to do the same thing in our business. We have to look at the economy of it and make some tough decisions. Would you like to not have to make them? Absolutely. You know, but that's life, and we have to do it with our own lives, with our own economy. So Investing Simplified is going to be back next week. I hear the music. So, Carl, how does somebody get a hold of you if they want to contact you during the week?
I can be reached at 503-255-8795 or warrenallen.com on the web.
Okay, and you're located where?
850 Northeast 122nd Avenue.
And we like to say conveniently located.
Conveniently.
And we're conveniently located right off of 205 at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue in the Price Financial Group building there right behind Elmer's Restaurant. You can also reach us on the web at www.pfgwm.com. And you can call me at 503-253-3000. And I don't have Kevin's information right here in front of me, but Kevin can be linked on our website. Also, if you click on my website and click on the Investing Simplified radio show, it'll have Kevin's link and also Carl's link on there, too.
And if memory serves me, his telephone number is 503-666-5569.
There you go. Very good. Hey, that's good memory on a Saturday morning. That's great. Well, thank you for listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be back next week. And don't forget, keep those numbers, 503-417-7626, and give us a call next week and let us know what's on your mind about investing. Thank you very much.